Good morning, Steve. I'm just wonderful this morning, and looking forward to the next several weeks, and looking forward in particular today to talk with Jack Gorey. Jack, let me pull my chair over here a little closer to you. And we're working with one microphone this morning, and we can get a little closer together here in the old KOZI other room. Jack, one of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you is I think it was last spring sometime I ran into you and your wife in Whaley's out in Manson, and you were excited about going to a reunion of your World War II bomber group. How is it that reunion came about and that you came to go there this summer?
I sort of expected our bomb group to have a reunion, so I kept looking in the American Legion magazine, and lo and behold, here it was, scheduled for July 30th through August 2nd of this year in Dayton, Ohio, and the person to contact to get the information on it was an old buddy of mine. We'd been through flying school, part of the flying school together, through training in B-24s, and we ended up in the same squadron overseas, and when we came back, we ended up as instructor pilots in Pueblo, Colorado. In fact, I even stood up with the man when he got married in Pueblo after we got back from overseas.
You have, I know, from remembering past conversations with you, some stories about being an active pilot in World War II that are particular favorites of mine. But first of all, I think maybe what we should do is ask folks who are not World War II history buffs to bear with us, because we're talking here with what was the name of the name of the big raid that you were commemorating?
The Pulaski Raid. It was the 40th anniversary of their raid in Romania on the Pulaski oil fields. It was a low-level raid, which was kind of a different type of operation for four-engine airplanes, as they went in very low, and it was supposed to be one of the big events of the war.
Now, the Pulaski raid is something that folks who were around in World War II or who are history buffs will certainly remember, and as we get into that, I'm sure it's going to prove to be a most fascinating story. But first of all, maybe we should know a little bit more about Jack Gorey and who you are and how you came to be participating in some of those very momentous events of the war. So, first of all, who are you? You've been a lifelong resident here?
Well, no. I moved to Chelan in 1965. I was born in the state of Washington over in Oak Harbor, 1917. And I moved to Brewster when I was about 4 years old. I was raised there. I went to University of Washington. And of course, they started the draft, so everyone was, I checked, and they said, well, I'd be in about July of 1941. I didn't want to be drafted, so I started looking around, and I was accepted as for flight training in they called it the Army Air Corps then. That was before they had a Air Force. It was part of the Army.
How did one get to be accepted for flight training in those days? Was it tough to get into?
It was fairly tough. You were required to have 2 years of college, and then their physical examination was, they checked that pretty close.
All right, when I stay up late enough to watch the TV go off now, we've got those jet airplanes going all over the place, and you think you almost have to be a computer genius in order to fly a plane anymore. What kind of training did you go through in those days?
Well, we were the first group that had kind of what they called a pre-flight training. In other words, they were really getting geared up. The war wasn't declared yet when I went in as a cadet. I went in November of 41, and of course the war didn't start till December 7th, so I just was barely in the service before the war started. And the training was, you went to a pre-flight school, and then you went to primary flight school, and that was run by civilians by contract. And that's where you soloed, and you got about 60 hours flying time. Then you went into basic training, and there you flew a higher-powered airplane. It had 450 horsepower with a big radial engine, and it was kind of a cranky thing to fly. And we got about another 60 hours, and that's where we got our first cross-country, first instrument flying, and a little bit of everything. Then we went to advanced flying school, and they usually sent you to a twin engine or a single engine. However, the school I went to was a new one, and So we had actually three types of planes to fly instead of one in advanced. We had twin engine and single engine. So I got a little bit of everything advanced, and I graduated in on July 1st of 1942 from flying school, and I got my wings and rated or the second lieutenant's rating, and so then they sent me to four-engine school.
So that initial training of the first three or four phases took about a year then?
A little less. They kind of accelerated it a little bit at that time. It was about 9 months. Not quite that long. I went in November and I graduated in July.
When you went into flight school, was there any question in your mind that you would be flying in a wartime situation someday?
Well, there's a little question, but it looked pretty well, especially after Pearl Harbor. Why, then it was, if you finished the training, it was pretty definite that you would go overseas somewhere and fly some type of plane.
On December 7th of 41, I would think that if I were a young man about to complete or midway through flight school, I'd be thinking, my goodness, I'm going to be one of the first guys over there. Did you have those kind of thoughts? Did it scare you?
Well, it was a hazardous occupation at that time. I mean, they told you that was for certain. And when Pearl Harbor happened, I was on my first leave. They quarantined you for, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks at flight school. And we had our first day off, and I was out in San Antonio, Texas, and they had some, kind of a jalopy race out there. And I was one of the fellas that had an automobile in flight school, and there's about five of us in a little Plymouth coupe I had that went out to these races, and then we heard it on the radio about Pearl Harbor. And it caused quite a confusion. I know some of the officers, they didn't have identification, and they couldn't get back on the base. Well, the cadets all had identification, so we didn't have any trouble. But a lot of our instructors, it took them a couple of days before they could get back on the base. It was kind of confusing.
Jack, when do you remember the first time you got in an airplane?
The first time I got in an airplane, I think I flew off of the airport out here at Chelan in a little two-place Taylor craft. However, I'd never flown. This was a friend of mine that was from Yakima. He came up here to spend a weekend with me and gave me a little hop. And
did that have anything to do with you deciding you wanted to go to flight school?
I think it did. I started getting interested in flying. And of course, that was kind of the thing to do at that time, was if you could get into flying, that seemed to be the elite thing to do if you could.
I've seen a whole series of National Geographic magazines from all through the Second World War, and every single ad in them had an airplane in it somewhere. If it was an ad for the railroad company, there was an airplane up in the sky.
Right.
Did you feel like a glamour boy? Did it help you socially to have the wings on your shirt?
Oh, I think it did. I'm not, I don't want to explain why, but I just think it did. It was,
Best leave that one alone for today. Jack, when you graduated from flight school, obviously by then the war was on.
Yes.
Where did you go? What did you do?
The first place they sent me was to Florida, Sebring, Florida, and I was supposed to be checked out as a co-pilot in a B-17. That was another four-engine airplane. And it was so confusing at that time when they assigned us to go there. They told us that at Lubbock, which is our advanced flying school, they thought it was a P-39, a fighter base. Well, they couldn't have been any farther off. When we got over there, we were in four engines. And then they were really accelerating then, I mean, getting ready for the war. And I spent about 6 weeks there. And then they sent me to the 2nd Air Force, and I went to Tucson, Arizona, to be checked out as an airplane commander on a B-24, which at that time was the biggest operational aircraft that the Air Force had.
How big were those steps from the training aircraft to the B-17 to the B-24? What kind of challenges were there in terms of flying them that were different one from the other?
Well, they were a huge aircraft at that time, and you even had trouble taxing a four-engine airplane. And they were big, like a the old B-24 was 110-foot wingspan, and the fuselage was 66 feet long. Well, now, when you compare that to a 747 of today, why, it's real small. But we had no control aids like you have power steering on your car now, no hydraulic boost or anything. It was all manual controlled, and made quite a difference when you went to fly one.
Was physical conditioning a big factor in flying those planes?
Well, of course, we were all young, and we had a stiff physical, so we were all in good shape. But it at times, it took quite a bit of stamina. I don't think I could fly one on a combat mission now. If you're out just flying around, why, it doesn't take too much. But when you get into a 30 or 40 four-engine airplane formation, why, at times, why, it takes quite a bit of physical stamina.
I want to talk a little bit about, you know, I think when we talk with folks who are veterans of World War II, and we tend to look at the movies and say, well, there are all those planes in formation, and that looks easy to do. I want to talk with you a little bit about that kind of thing. It would seem to me that turbulence, if you're flying in a tight formation, would be a dangerous thing. Did you ever have incidents where you clipped each other's wings, that kind of thing?
I never did. On top of turbulence, if the air was rough, why, there was always, with that many planes, you'd hit prop wash from the planes ahead of you. And sometimes that was really more of a problem than the turbulence. And if you hit a lot of turbulence, why, you'd kind of open your formation up a little bit. You didn't try to fly quite as close.
How many planes were usually in a formation of bombers?
When I was overseas, we had... each group would try to have 24 to 27, and we usually flew alone in our group. However, there was another group over there, the 98th Bomb Group, and they'd try and put up the same number. Each squadron would try to get six or seven airplanes in the group. There was four squadrons.
Okay, with that many airplanes, you can't take off in formation. The runway isn't that wide. How in the world, what was the simple mechanical process of getting everybody where they were supposed to be before you went on your mission?
Well, it was just a simple procedure you went through. The lead airplane would take off and fly straight ahead, like, say, 3 minutes, and then every 30 seconds, the next plane would take off. Now, that was where when we were in training, we'd space them at 30 seconds, and then they'd fly straight ahead for, say, 3 minutes, and then they'd make a procedure turn to the left. Well, when the lead airplane turned, everybody else had turned at the same time, so here you were. And then when the lead airplane got down to the about your takeoff point, well, you should be formed six together. Then that group of six would make a pattern. They'd fly about 3 minutes down past each the airport, and then make another procedure turn to the left and pick up the next six. And that's the way we got together. Like I say, we started out at 30-second intervals on takeoff, and after we were overseas a little while and had a little time, we were down to 10 seconds, real close. We didn't want to waste time and gas out there forming up. We wanted to save our missions. A lot of times were so long that your gasoline supply was quite a problem. Sometimes it seemed like you just came home on the fumes.
When you graduated from flight school, you went to Florida to fly bombers. You weren't bombing anything in Florida. What were you doing there?
Well, it was just training. In other words, they figured that was when they started having a written procedure, what they called a checklist. On the four-engine planes, you had about 100 items you had to go through. The co-pilot would call them off, and you'd check every little thing and run the engines up and everything. And however, we did do just a little bombing there. On our training mission, sometimes they'd put some depth charges in, and we'd go out and look for submarines, make about a five-hour patrol. I remember one incident there. A friend of mine, his name was Thor Hamron, graduated from school, flying school with me, and he was in one of these B-17s, and they put a depth charge in, and then they put 10 little 100-pound practice bombs. Well, they were supposed to go out and on this bombing target and drop the 10 practice bombs and then go out and go on submarine patrol for 5 hours. Well, some way they goofed up and they, on this bombing target, they dropped the depth charge. Well, it was a little bayou down there in Florida, and they just blew that thing almost bone dry.
I'll bet so. We're talking this morning with Jack Gorey, and going to be talking more with Jack about his experiences in World War II and having a good time as Radio Lake Chelan's Month of Heritage gets underway. But let's take a commercial break here, and we'll be back with Jack in a moment. It can't be 9:25 already. My goodness, time is zipping on by here. Jack Gorey is our guest today. Jack flew some very interesting missions in World War II. One of the missions I remember that you telling me about that to me was the most fascinating at all was just getting out of the United States and over to the theaters of war. Tell me a little bit about that. First of all, the whole training process. You were doing the four-engine airplanes. When was that all done? And you were told that you were going to be going overseas.
Well, from Tucson, we went to Alamogordo in Texas, or, yeah, no, New Mexico, excuse me, Alamogordo, and that was a base that they had built for the British, and they'd turned it down, and that was the first time that I flew a B-24 on my own. I had some friends in Tucson that were... they'd been instructor pilots, and they'd let me land it. I mean, I really wasn't supposed to, I guess, but they let me do it. So I got a little bit of experience from some older hands. And the first time we went down to that I flew on my own was at Alamogordo. Well, they were short on gas at Alamogordo, so on our flight, why we were supposed to go over to El Paso and gas up just the end of our mission before we came back to our home base so that the next crew would have a tank of gas. Well, the civilian airport and the Air Force airport were right next to each other. And on my solo flight in the B-24, I landed at the wrong airport. Got the radio deal and taxied up to the deal to get the gas, and they said, then the Air Force base said, well, where are you? And we said, well, we're right down here in front of operations. Can't you see us? Well, no. So we had to take off and go about a mile to get to the other airport. And from Alamogordo, on our training mission, missions, we went to Pueblo, Colorado, spent a month there with more training, and then we went to Topeka, Kansas. And we had 30 days of training there. And the weather was pretty bad there at times, and I remember they didn't have a radio range to let down when the weather was bad in Topeka. So we'd home in on a commercial station. We'd turn the radio compass on and go in and wouldn't have any trouble. Well, one night the weather was real bad, and they kept us up there until that commercial station was closed, so we had no radio station to get in on. And the weather was bad, and we were low on fuel. We couldn't go anywhere. Kansas City was closed. And so what are we going to do? Well, we were on top of the clouds, and we could fly over the town, and we could see the lights through the clouds. So we went over the town. We went out on our determined course and let down two-thirds of our altitude, made our procedure turn so we'd come back over the town. Well, I'll tell you, it was real low. We only had about a 200-foot ceiling. And we went right down the main street of Topeka past the state capitol, and we were looking up at it when we went by it. And we followed the road out and landed at the field. I mean, we knew the mag heading, compass heading to follow from the town, and how many seconds it'd take us to get to the air base. And it was so close that we thought we'd missed it. But the engineer said, there it is off our left wing, and I made a sharp turn to the left, and we were real close to the ground, but I missed the runway. It was so close. So we went around the field again, and that time somebody else was up there having trouble, and he'd landed the wrong way on the runway. In other words, he was going to get it down any way he could, so we had to make another circle. So we did, and it just seemed like I just made my final turn and got it straightened up, and we hit the ground, and the weather was so bad there that the windows were all frosted over. By the time we finished our landing roll, that they had to send a tug out to get us off the runway. We couldn't see. And that was just one of the experiences where you weren't in combat, where it was kind of a close call. Then we got our airplanes when we were in Topeka. We had to go to Salinas, I think it was. Salinas, I don't know how you pronounce it, to pick it up. Well, lo and behold, here was a pink airplane. Well, it was almost a certainty then that we would be going to the North African theater.
Why would you know that if you had a pink airplane?
Because that was the only place that they had a difference from the olive drab paint job that was on most of the aircraft at that time.
Was that to blend with the sand or what?
It was supposed to, but it was just one of those things that didn't blend at all. it was supposed to, but it didn't happen that way.
Okay, so you knew you'd be going to North Africa, where Rommel was working and so on on the other side. How did you get from Salinas, California to North Africa in the theater of war?
All right, we flew from Topeka, Kansas to West Palm Beach, Florida. And there they processed us. They checked and made sure we had everything. We had this B-24. And I can remember I still got the deal where I signed for this airplane. And that was kind of a funny little incident, too. They had one B-24, serial number such and such, aircraft complete with overseas kit, one Norden bomb sight complete, and two rolls of TP. Now that was the three items on that big deal. And why they had two rolls of TP, I don't know. But that's the way it was. So they gave us our orders then. We were spent about 3 days in West Palm Beach being processed, and they checked your shots, and if somebody lost their shot record, and I know one of my gunners did, and I gave him the whole series in one day. Just like they did in all the services at that time. And they gave us our orders, and we were to fly out, and they said, you're supposed to fly 2 hours, in other words, to make sure you're on your way overseas before you open the orders to find out where to go. Well, I think it was a pretty short 2 hours before we opened them, and we were supposed to report to 9th Bomber Command in Cairo, Egypt. So, I don't know, we followed the southern route overseas. We went from West Palm Beach to Puerto Rico, and from Puerto Rico to Georgetown, British Guiana. And from there, we were supposed to go to Belém, which was an airport they had at the mouth of the Amazon River. However, they were out of fuel at that time, and we didn't have enough fuel to fly on to Natal in Brazil, so we landed at a commercial airport in a town called Fortaleza, and we stayed there all night, and we bought gasoline from Pan Am Airways at that time, and I remember gasoline was, you could buy it for less than 20 cents a gallon for your car here, and I signed a chit for 1,000 gallons of gasoline, $1,000, which was seemed like a big price, but I think they had to haul it in there. It was inland a ways, and they probably had to fly most of the gasoline in. And from there, we flew to Natal, Brazil. And Natal was on the coast, and I believe it has a climate very similar to like the Hawaiian Islands. And from Natal, we flew out in the South Atlantic and landed on a little island called Ascension Island.
Tell me about Ascension Island. I've heard stories about Ascension Island, that it's small enough that you had to be fairly good just to find the thing, let alone set a plane down on it.
That's right. Like the saying was, Miss Ascension, my wife will get a pension. That was a saying at that time. However, when we took off from Natal, I tuned in the radio compass, and they had a real strong radio station there, and the needle went around three or four times and went right straight to Natal, or Ascension, I mean, from Natal. And the weather was good and had no problems. It was, the British owned this little island, and they said it was impossible to build an airport on it. However, it was very unique. In other words, it had a bulge in the center of it. When you landed on the end of the runway, you couldn't see the end of it, and you had to go up kind of a little grade. And that was kind of disconcerting. You come in and you can't see where you're going to stop, and you know you haven't got room as far as you can see. And they had to haul all our water in. And I remember when we went into Ascension, when we got close to it, why, all of a sudden we looked out and here was a P-39 on our right wing, and we kind of looked at that and we looked over and here was another one on the left. In other words, they wanted to make sure who was coming into the island, and they had you'd be escorted in by a fighter plane and made sure who you were, and you stayed there all night. And from there we went to the Gold Coast of in Across in Africa, and that was kind of a spooky place getting in there too.
What made that difficult to hit?
Well, it was a little, they kind of have a haze over there, and you couldn't see too far. And it was, I mean, Africa, the whole continent of Africa, of course, you couldn't miss it from Ascension, but to get into the right place, that was the thing if the weather was a little bad. And that was quite a place there. I mean, we went downtown. I think we stayed over one day there, and it was quite a unique place, all right. I mean, the women were, all they wore was a skirt, and they were tall, and they could carry more on top of their head than you could believe. Yeah. And then from Ascension, we went out and flew to the middle of Africa, then to Khartoum. Now, Khartoum was right on the edge of the jungle, and I don't know, it was kind of a weird place. And all I can remember is they had this big building and it had a huge roof, and it was just filled with cots of people, and they had armed guards there, and you could hear all this noise from the jungle all night. It was kind of disconcerting, and it was quite a unique place, but they made sure that you were taken care of. And from Khartoum, then we went to Cairo.
Okay, why would you have been sent? What was your mission once you reached Egypt? That was your point of destination. What were you going to do there?
Well, they had 9th Bomber Command, and we landed at Helpro Airport, and it didn't even have runways then. It was just a big field. And when we got there, we had picked up a P-40 pilot that on Ascension Island, and he flew with us from Ascension Island all the way to Cairo. And the reason was that they kicked him off the airplane because they were overloaded, and they thought some of the cargo was more important to get over there than the P-40 pilot, I guess. But it was real hot, and we looked at that runway looked at that airfield, and we thought, they don't want a B-24 in there. There isn't room enough. Well, we flew around, and all we could find was a couple of little fighter fields around, and, well, we went back, and sure enough, there was a B-24 parked down there, so we knew we had to get in. And I know that we threw rocks and everything all over a building, and people come running out of the building because we just barely, you know, it was hot in the afternoon, and we had to go in fairly fast. And we used all of the runway up and had to make a big turn at the end. And we stayed there all night, and I can remember, you know, you always think that the Americans have the best of everything, and they loaded us in a GI 6x6, our crew, to take us to our quarters, and we went by some real nice quarters, you know, like for the British and the French Foreign Legion and so forth. And when we got out to ours, here was a dirty tar paper shack, and it wasn't too good, but we only stayed there one day, and then they sent us out to our to the 376 bomb group, which was at that time stationed at Saluk in Libya.
We're talking this morning with Jack Gorey about some of his experiences in the World War II era as Radio Lake Chelan's Month of Heritage continues, and we'll come back and talk with Jack some more after we take a commercial message. Steve, Jack and I got to talking here while we were off the air and almost forgot what we're supposed to be doing here. J. Jack, you were mentioning to me just as we were off the air that there was a rather interesting man that that you flew over to Egypt with. Tell us about that.
Well, when we left West Palm Beach, there was six B-24 crews. There's nine men on each crew. And one of those six crews was Lieutenant Hatton's crew. Now, he was the one on that ill-fated aircraft, the Lady Be Good. And I believe it was Hatton's first mission as the first pilot on an aircraft that he got lost, and he was about 400 miles out in the desert, and I'm sure everyone's heard about the Lady Be Good, and they found him in 19, I can't remember whether it was 56 or 59, an oil drilling crew found the aircraft out there, perfectly preserved, because there's no moisture out in the Sahara Desert, and there's quite a story about it.
I believe that that they found his body, and was it he who had written the diary of went on for days and days and days? I know one of the crew had written a diary that they also found.
Yes, it was one of the crew. I can't remember whether it was the navigator or the flight engineer that wrote this diary, and they found the remains of almost all of the men. I believe all but one. Now, at the reunion, they had a movie showing all of the different deals after they found the airplane, and it was really quite an effort, and they spent a lot of money to run down just what had happened. And these fellas did everything by the book what they were supposed to do when you landed in the desert, as far as conserving water and, like you say, keeping a diary, and they split up, but unless you found them, why, there's just no way. In fact, we thought that they'd gone down out at over the Mediterranean somewhere, and I believe I flew on one a few hours over there on a search to try and locate him. But we were out over the Mediterranean rather than out over the desert. What happened? They'd had quite a tailwind, and they were going so much faster than they thought that they didn't realize they'd gone over the top of the base where they were supposed to land. And then at the Germans were pretty smart. We had a island of Malta that we were supposed to land on if we were in trouble, which was controlled by the British. And just not too far from Malta was Sicily, and the Germans put up a direction finding station, and they put it on almost the same frequency, very close to it, only their station was a lot stronger. And they would give you a false heading. And that was one of their tricks, was to give you a false heading and turn you around and run you out over the Mediterranean until you'd run out of fuel. And that's what we thought had happened to Hatton. But evidently, he had gotten our ground station, and when they told him to turn around, he wouldn't believe him. He thought it was the Germans giving him a false deal. And they'd been going, had such a terrific tailwind that they'd gone so much farther. And it's real easy with, you know, radio navigation aids were fairly primitive at that time. And that's what happened to him.
If he was going a lot faster than he thought it would have, if he was going faster than he thought he was, then it would have been logical for him to assume that the right station was indeed the wrong one.
Right.
Why would you be in Egypt flying in World War II? I mean, we've all heard about the invasion of Normandy. We know that missions were flown over over Italy. What did you do in Egypt? What was the purpose?
Well, actually, in Egypt, you mean Libya. That's where we ended up being stationed. But we'd bomb mostly in Italy. In other words, Rommel was still in North Africa, and when I first got there, we were bombing his supply lines, the Straits of Messina. In other words, they'd take the supplies across the straits from the toe of Italy onto Sicily, and then take them across in Sicily by train, and then put them on ships and take them to North Africa to Rommel. So we were trying to, that was one of our main objectives at that time, was to destroy his supply line.
Jack, kind of, if you can, take us through a day in which you were going to run a bombing run. I mean, You know, again, when we watch the movies, we see the guys jump on the airplane. The next thing you know, they're over the target. They drop the bombs, and the next thing they know, they get off the airplanes and go see their girlfriends. It couldn't have been that simple. Can you sort of put yourself in back 40 years ago and take me through that day?
Well, yes. First of all, they'd each squadron had their own little operations office, and if they had a mission, why they'd put the crew on the board, the ones that were going. And they'd set up a briefing time. And now sometimes they'd brief you in the evening before the mission, but usually they'd wait in the morning until morning, because if they briefed you in the evening, they might want to change it. In other words, you know, the changes were quite frequent at times. So they'd get you up real early in the morning, and you'd have breakfast before daylight, and then you'd go to the briefing. Well, at the briefing, they'd have a general briefing for all the crew members, and they'd tell you what your target was, what your IP was, the different times, the times for takeoff, your position in the formation, and all the pertinent data that was needed, what time you'd start your climb to altitude, and what altitude you'd go to, and all of that information, the kind of a turn you'd make off of the target. They'd tell you what opposition you might expect, and sometimes they were fairly accurate on that.
Is that like saying many times they were wrong?
Sometimes they were wrong, yeah, there'd be more or less. Our group commander, he was, he had kind of a knack. He's always, we'd bomb the same target as the 98th bomb group, and sometimes we'd go in first, and then about 3 minutes later, the other bomb group would come from another direction and hit the same target. Well, if we went in first, our group CO said, well, he says, you don't have anything to worry about today. He said, you'll be the first ones in, and you'll surprise them, and you'll be gone before the ACAC gunners and the fighters get up. But he says, that poor 98th group, by the time they get there, why, it's going to be too late. Well, if we were number two, then he'd switch his story around. He'd say, oh, you don't have to worry. The guns will all be hot, and they'll be out of ammunition, shooting them at the 98th group, and the fighters will be out of fuel, and you'll come in second, and they'll all be gone, and you'll just have a milk run. So he was really quite a fellow that way. And then you'd have, of course, getting back to the deal, you'd have your takeoff time, and you'd have an old 6x6, and they'd, I don't know how you could get so many people on one old truck to take you out to your airplanes, because they were all dispersed, you know, at intervals out on the field. They weren't lined up in a line like you see in the movies. I mean, they were probably, a quarter or half a mile apart. They'd have a different parking area for each plane, so if the enemy bombed you, why, they couldn't put all your airplanes out of commission. They could only get a few. And you'd start your engines up. They'd have a time for you to start your engines. And usually our missions were long enough that we'd start our engines up and taxi over to takeoff position. And then the gas truck would come and top our planes off after we'd run our engines up. So when it was time to take off, why, we had every drop of fuel we could get in. And then we'd have our formation, would get together, and the lead airplane would take us out, and we had a corridor to go through. And after we moved from Saluk to Benghazi, the British had a lot of balloons above the town to keep the German airplanes from flying in low. It was kind of a protection. And we had to usually take off headed right for those balloons, and I think that's one reason we cut our time down to 10-second intervals from 30 seconds, so we didn't have to get close to those balloons before we made our turn. Yeah. And so then we'd fly out over the Mediterranean, usually at about 1,500 feet altitude, until we got close to the, Italy, which was where we usually went, and we'd have a time to start climbing. Well, of course, we were on radio silence, so we'd signal by the lead plane when we were supposed to time, where you had to, when it was to climb, you had to change all your power settings, you had to up your RPMs and put your everything enrich and add more power to climb, well, we'd signal that by shooting flares. They'd give you a different colored flare. It was just kind of well, your flares were kind of like a big shotgun, you might say, only they were in the form of a pistol, and you had a deal like taking a gasoline cap off where you had a hole to put it through, and then you'd put that pistol through the fuselage of the airplane and pull the trigger. And it was probably like about a 8-gauge shotgun shell, or maybe bigger than that even. They were a pretty good sized shell. And they'd signal that, and then they'd signal when you were at the top of your climb, and they'd shoot another flare, like when you're at your IP and so forth. And then, of course, you use your flares for emergency signals, too.
What's the IP?
Initial point. In other words, you don't fly straight into the target. You'd fly to an initial point, they call it, and maybe you were 2 or 3 minutes from the target, and you'd make a turn one way or the other. That was to give you, to help you in navigating to get there. In other words, if you went right straight to the target, you'd be kind of hard to get lined up on it. But when you knew exactly what your heading would be from the IP to the target.
Okay, so you're at your initial point. You're flying the airplane. You've got a co-pilot with you and a navigator and somebody to drop the bombs. Who else was on the airplane?
Well, we had 9 members on the plane. There was 4 officers and 5 enlisted men. You had your pilot, co-pilot, navigator, and bombardier. And then you had, on your enlisted men, you had the flight engineer, radio operator, and then, of course, the assistant flight engineer and assistant radio operator, tail gunner. And then, of course, the radio operator and engineers, why, they were all gunners when you went over the target. Like the flight engineer had the top turret, and the navigator and bombardier, they had some flexible guns in the nose that they fired, and you had 2 waist gunners and a tail gunner. And then there was one fella that went through the camera hatch with one on the bottom on a swivel.
When it was time to go over a target and drop the bombs, some of the movies I've seen, you see pilots looking out the windows and grinning each other and doing thumbs up signs and things like that. Do you have time for that?
You really didn't have that much time. I mean, you'd pull your formation right in tight together, but usually that's when you'd do your evasive action to get away from the anti-aircraft shells, and you were pretty busy. And if there was some fighter planes, why, the guns were firing, and it makes quite a commotion. There's a lot of noise. You got a lot of power on, and it's kind of wild at that time at times.
About when would the other side know you were coming? I mean, if you were 2 or 3 minutes from the target at your initial point, you must have known that pretty soon you were going to start getting some opposition.
Well, usually the fighters would get you once in a while before they got there. One interesting thing, I don't know, I haven't seen it, but the anti-aircraft usually would be firing, and they would... When it was time, when they wanted to signal to the fighter boys that they would quit firing so they could come in and work you over, they'd shoot colored AK-AK. So you knew when you saw the colored AK-AK that you better hang on. Here came the fighters. And that's just one way that they had to signal.
You were more nervous about the fighters then than the ground fire?
I think so. They were both pretty nerve-wracking. And, of course, different targets would have a different amount of... AK-AK. Now, over the Straits of Messina, they called that AK-AK Alley because that was they just put up a barrage of it and you had to fly through it. It just sounded like hail on a metal roof at times. It was so thick and you'd just, you just have to bow your neck and hang on and go.
How about the bombing run itself? When you came to the target, I know the movie 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, I think that referred to the pilot had to give the bombardier a straight run for 30 seconds before he hit the target or something like that, didn't he?
You were supposed to give him 30 seconds. Now, the bombardiers would vary quite a bit. I was real lucky. I had a bombardier. I'll swear he could make a 10-second run and if he had to, and be pretty accurate.
So what did you do? You're trying to fly around ACAC and airplanes and that kind of thing, and who told you that it was time to settle down the airplane and let the bombardier do his thing?
Well, that's one reason you hit the initial point. And you had a little needle that you followed when the bombardier had his sight, but usually you'd bomb in three airplanes where just one of them would be following the bomb sight and the others would just bomb off of your wing, or sometimes it'd be six, sometimes it'd be 12, or sometimes a whole group. I've seen the whole group go over and just salvo the bombs all at once. Depended on the target.
What would go through your mind when, you know, you're trained to do all kinds of evasive things and be a hotshot pilot, and somebody says, all right, now you can't touch nothing, we've got to go straight here till the bombs are loose. Was that a long 10 or 20 or 30 seconds for you?
Very long at times, very long. Especially if you had a lot of, anti-aircraft fire. And sometimes that could be quite intense. Sometimes you were lucky you didn't have much opposition.
When the guy said the bombs were away, what would you do then?
Well, usually you'd keep your formation real tight, and they'd make a turn off of the target, one way or the other, and you'd reduce your power and start letting down. We were lucky; we were over. We were along the coast, and we could pull out and start letting down. In other words, we didn't have to hold our altitude very long, which helped us a lot, because if somebody had, had an engine knocked out by anti-aircraft, or if one had just went out with a reduced power, why, he could stay right in there on three engines if he had to. So that was one reason we started a slight descent.
How long a day was that from? Was it a long flight for you? Was it a dusk to dawn or dawn to dusk kind of flight?
Well, they varied. Your tour of duty at that time in our theater was 300 combat hours. And that constituted from the time you took off till you landed, if you hit your target. Now, if you took off and had to abort, it didn't count. And I had 33 missions. And a little over 300 hours, I think I ended up with 306, something like that. And my missions would vary from around 6 hours and as high as 13 hours in the air, and that's a long time.
Yeah, I would think that would be a long time. I think one story you told me earlier was there not a time when you had to fall back, or did fall back, come out of your formation and wait for a friend whose plane was hit or something like that?
Well, no, you don't fall out of formation and wait very long. You're supposed to stay in the formation. However, after I'd been over there quite a while, pilot I knew, I was flying on his left wing, and he got two 88-millimeter German anti-aircraft shells right through his plane, and his whole crew had to bomb out, or had to bail out over Foggia. And the crew was supposed to count how many parachutes come out, and these fellas all bailed out. I knew the whole crew, and that was kind of interesting, because when I went to the reunion in Dayton, Ohio, the bombardier on this crew, I hadn't seen him since he had bailed out on the 13th of August of 1943 over Foggia. And so he told me all about being in the POW camp and how he was treated. And he was taken from Italy. He ended up in Germany in a POW camp in Germany till the war was over in Germany.
Where was Foggia?
Foggia was up in the middle of Italy, and they had a lot of fighter bases up there. And, it was mostly wheat country, really. I mean, a lot of wheat fields there, fairly flat. So they had a lot, the Germans had a lot of fighter planes there.
Must have been a strange experience for you to look at that man and say, the last time I saw you, you were just a parachute in the air. And I would imagine that you were all a little bit scared at that point.
Yeah, we were real scared, and he had quite a tale to tell. In other words, when we had our reunion there, we were at, went out and visited Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is quite a, they have a big museum there. They have all kinds of aircraft, both American and foreign aircraft, almost everything that you can think of, and a lot that you can't even think of. And they had even had the capsules that space capsules in there. And one thing they had was a lot of the things that the POWs had made when in Germany. Well, we were at this museum going through, and my friend Pete Hansen, who was the bombardier that I'd seen bail out, he looked at it. He said, "I helped make that radio, and I helped make that." They had a fancy mouse trap and so forth there, and he'd help make those. But it was really something to see him. I mean, haven't seen him for 40 years. My wife says, "Well, you fellows were swearing at each other and everything, but you had tears in your eyes."
I imagine you did. That reunion commemorated, I think, the 40th anniversary of one of the major bombing raids of the war. What raid was it? And tell us a little bit about the mission that the reunion helped to commemorate.
Well, it was sort of an ill-fated mission in a way, but they wanted to have this low-level raid, they called it, on the Romanian oil fields. And we had two groups, like I said, that were normally stationed in North Africa at Benghazi, the 98th and the 376th. And for this raid on Palestine, they brought in three more bomb groups. They brought, I can't remember now, they brought one or two of the bomb groups down from England, and one of them was right out of the States. So we had five bomb groups there for about, 6 weeks or 6 to 8 weeks, and they went on a few raids with us. But initially they wanted to, Romania supplied so much of the oil and so forth for the German war machine, they wanted to knock it out. So they got this idea of going in at low level, and they even set up a dummy targets and everything out on the desert. And they practiced this low level bombing all for a couple of weeks out there. And so then on the morning of, I didn't actually go on the mission. I was out of commission. Some of my crew was in the hospital, and I didn't have an airplane. Maybe that's one reason I'm here today, is because I didn't go on that mission. Some of my friends did. Some of them made it, and some of them didn't. But it was, they had to take off from Benghazi, Libya, and it was a long mission. And then they had to climb over some mountains to get there. And they hit bad weather over the mountains, so that kind of fouled up the formation some. And then one group made the wrong turn. In other words, on their initial point, they had a little town they were supposed to go over. Well, sometimes on your maps, these little towns look very similar, and it was close, and they made the wrong turn off the IP, so they missed the target. And then one group took longer getting through the bad weather, and they were late. However, they did do extensive damage to the target, even with all the trouble they had, and a lot of them landed and didn't make it back to the base. It was kind of a bad day.
I know that that raid received a lot of publicity, and of course, at the time, I guess you call it propaganda. Yep. At the time, it was billed as a highly successful thing, and so on. When the word was put out to the American public. Do you have any idea how many planes were involved in the raid and what the loss ratio was or anything like that?
There was 177 planes on the raid. I can't remember how many of them made it over the target, but most of them did. And there weren't too many planes made it back to their home base. Now, there was a lot of them that landed in other places. Some of them landed in Turkey different places, but the losses were about 50%. Some of the groups really took a beating on it.
You had kind of a unique position yourself in that raid, in that you were one of the guys who did not go because your plane wasn't there and so on. What kind of thing would go through your mind when you knew that big of an action was there and you were going to be cooling your heels? Were you glad? Did it bother you? How would you feel?
Well, you had mixed emotions, really. Now, my co-pilot and I, we were spare pilots. And we wanted to go, but I don't know, I can remember my co-pilot, he said, you know, why don't we just wait here? We don't need to go where they're taking off. He said, let them come find us. He said, I'd like to go on it, but he said, going as a spare pilot, I don't know what crew I'd be with. And we really wanted to go, but at the same time, we knew it was going to be a rough mission.
You had a lot of friends that were on that raid. You mentioned some of them that some came back and others didn't. Right. As the day went on that day, was there a time when you knew that most of those planes weren't coming back to where they started from? How did that information get unveiled to you guys?
Well, of course, they sent a radio message back that they'd hit the target and it was a successful mission. And it was fairly successful. However, it wasn't perfect. You know, they wanted to do more damage than they did, naturally. But I can remember the planes coming back, some of them all shot up and shooting their red flares to signal that they were in trouble. And I think our squadron was probably pretty lucky. We lost one plane out of our squadron. Sent up six planes, but our group was probably didn't lose quite as many planes as a lot of them because we were we were the oldest group over there, and they probably had a little more experience and so forth and operating out of there.
Jack, when you were flying that kind of a mission, was the 33rd mission you flew as scary to you as the first?
Well, like I say, you had 300 hours you had to put in. And when you first went over there, you really didn't give yourself too much of a chance. And then when you got up, say, over 200 hours in, you thought, by golly, maybe I am going to make it. Then you really started, you did, it made you a little more nervous. I mean, you knew you had more experience and a better chance. However, at the same time, that it didn't always happen that way.
So in some ways you were more nervous the closer you got to being finished than you were when you started.
That's right, yeah.
When you were an old pro over there, what, old pro, probably 23, 24 years old, something like that?
Well, actually, you know, I was a little older than most of the pilots over there. I was, 26.
Well, you were definitely an old man then.
Yeah, I was really an old man in that outfit.
After you'd been there for a while, and new pilots would come in. Would they seek out guys like you who'd been there for a while? Did you feel a sense of responsibility toward those newer guys?
Oh, that's right. And usually they'd try to when you'd get a new crew, they wouldn't take their whole crew out the first time and go on a mission. They'd put the pilot have him fly co-pilot a couple of times with an experienced hand. And then they'd scatter his gunners around, navigator and so forth. And they'd all get a couple, three missions in anyway before they put the crew back together and they went out on their own. And that helped a lot. And after you get your 200 hours, my co-pilot was checked out as a first pilot. And most of the co-pilots were. And then you'd take new crew members out with you and try and show them the ropes.
Let me throw you a curve here. You had some exciting experiences there. I know many that we haven't talked about today that we talked about the last time you were on. Do you think that experiences that fellows like yourself had, does it give you a different perspective when you look at current affairs of things like invading Grenada and things like that? Does it give you a different perspective on that kind of world problem than maybe those of us who didn't live through those kind of experiences that you did?
Well, I don't know just how to explain that, but we know what they're going through. We put that. In other words, in Grenada, and the Marines over in Lebanon, Beirut, you know what they're going through. And of course, I was stationed in the Middle East, and that's just a different world over there than it is here. The people are different, they think different, and what we think is moral, they think is immoral, and vice versa. And they just think different than we do.
If you had to give advice to a young man who was going to go to Lebanon or wherever it may be, what would you say as a guy who's been through the mill to one who's about to go through it? What kind of advice would you give him?
Well, I don't know just what advice you could give him except to, not volunteer for any extra hazardous duty, like they always say in the service. Just get all the training you can.
I think a guy told me once to stay in the middle. At all times, stay in the middle.
That's probably good advice. It's hard to give advice because, you just can't give advice on that. A lot of us just kind of like the flip of the coin. I mean, like when I was over there, some of the best pilots that were over there, something happened to them. Something happened to their plane. They'd go down. And some of the pilots that weren't so good made it through, so I don't know. I mean, you didn't consider them, you could kind of tell some of them were better pilots than others.
Maybe one will pop to mind. Was there ever a time when a situation required you to do something with your airplane that you weren't sure you could do and maybe you surprised yourself?
Well, a lot of times you got, shot up. And after you've had a little experience, sometimes that what people would think was quite an emergency in an airplane, why we didn't consider it much of an emergency. Like if we had a nose gear shot out, why that was no problem at all. That didn't hardly, didn't bother you. Of course, if something happened to your main landing gear, that was different. But, a lot of times you just had to have a lot of confidence. That's all. You just had to know you were going to make it, one way or another. Sometimes you didn't know. I know on July the 8th in 43, we got shot up real bad over Catania, and we had to make it into Malta. Well, we had everything wrong with that airplane. We had two good engines, one feathered and the other, we actually had one good engine and two bad ones, and one shut down, and our hydraulic system was gone, so that meant we had no brakes. We had to wind our landing gear down by hand. We knew our nose gear was gone. We had no flap actions, and we couldn't even change the propeller pitch.
It's not supposed to stay in the air under those conditions, is it?
Not really. And our main concern then was when we came in to land on Malta, they were getting ready for the invasion of Sicily, and they had all of these, the whole harbor was full of ships, and here we were, we had no radio.